All right, so the heading is on 1561, but we'll really start over here in page 1562, your December 6 reading, Romans chapter 1. You'll note that on the screen, in the salutation here, I have highlighted that's verse 5. Through him we received grace and apostleship to call all the Gentiles to what?
The obedience that comes from faith.
To the obedience that comes from faith. So when we get into this book, we are going to hear Paul say a lot about faith and it not being of works, right? That's what people that you talk to about the book of Romans are going to know about the book of Romans, is that chapters 4 and 5 are, it's of faith, it's not of works, right? And so boasting is excluded. Note the way Paul begins this book. Take nothing away from his remarks about how important faith is. That is the point of his book, right? The point of the book is it's faith, it's not works. That's the system that we are now in, and we'll talk more about that as we get into it. But how does he start this book? What is he thinking about when he thinks about faith, when he's speaking about faith? What is he talking about?
Obedience.
It's a faith that drives obedience, right? And don't miss that point, because Paul doesn't want you to miss that point. He begins with that point here in the very first paragraph. What are the Gentiles called to? It's to the obedience that comes from faith, right? Faith is critical. It's important. It is what the Lord is looking for, but it is a faith that drives obedience. And Paul doesn't want you to miss that point. I know that because he ends the book the exact same way over on page 1581. All the Gentiles might come. So that all the Gentiles might come to what? To the obedience that comes from faith. Is Paul haphazard in his writing? I mean, sometimes he runs down trails like, I was about to say like my grandmother used to, but I guess like I do. Sometimes he runs down rabbit trails when he's talking to you, right? But is Paul ever not thoughtful in what he says? And look what he's done with this book. He starts out the book talking about the obedience that comes from faith, and he ends the book talking about the obedience that comes from faith. Paul, the apostle, by the Holy Spirit, has bookended this to tell you, beginning and end, what I'm talking about is a faith that's obedient. And if you miss that, you have missed a major part of the book. And he's going to spend a lot of time in the middle of this book, if you are paying attention to it. I mean, again, chapters 4 and 5, he is emphasizing the importance of faith. What is chapter 6?
Faith leads to baptism.
Yeah, chapter 6 is where we live, right? And we ought to get that far today. Chapter 6 is where we live. And so over in chapter 6, let's turn there, page 1568. After he's talked about faith and the importance of it, he's going to say, shall we go on sinning so that grace may increase? Right? So is your obedience going to be important, or is if you got faith, that's enough? Is the question he's asking. Well, I've got faith, that's enough. Do I go on sinning? No. In fact, I mean, it's translated in the NIV, by no means. Any of you guys remember your other translations that are not hesitant to use some of the language that the Spirit actually uses there? The phrase of the Spirit is God forbid. I don't know why a translator wouldn't want to say that. Because maybe they think it's flippant about his name. But that's an important phrase. Should we go on sinning? God forbid. That's not what I sacrificed my son for you to go on sinning. And look what he says. I mean, this is where we live. Do not let sin reign. Do not offer any part of yourself to sin as an instrument of wickedness. For sin shall no longer be your master. You are slaves, whether slaves to sin or to obedience. You have become slaves of God. To the benefit you reap leads to holiness. What is holiness? It's being sanctified. It's being set apart. If you're walking in the world, are you sanctified or set apart? No, you're absolutely not. So, and we could go on and on. We could go over and turn to chapter 12, verse 1. Present yourselves as living sacrifices. That's what it's about, right? Okay, so let's turn over back to the beginning of the book. And another observation about this this passage here. Speaking of the, the gospel he promised beforehand through his prophets in the Holy Scriptures regarding his son, who as to his earthly life was a descendant of David. Why do we say that? Because we're talking about the promises, and he's going to be talking to Jews and Gentiles in this book, right? He's going to spend chapters 9 and 11 specifically talking to the Jews. Or rather about the Jews and to some of them. And he does care about the promises that are made. And so the promise was first to Abraham, right? That it would be through his line, and then specifically to David, that he would have it would come from his house, and the king would sit on his throne. Who through the Spirit of holiness was appointed the Son of God in power by his resurrection from the dead. That's a big mouthful, right? My version doesn't say appointed the Son of God. It says declared the Son of God. Declared the Son of God in power by what? By his resurrection. And I've spoken to you about it before over in Acts chapter 13, verse 33, right? The Apostle Paul is going to say, well, let's go there. The Apostle Paul, I think it's 1508, because I've got it tagged for another reason there. Yep, it's 1508. When he is speaking of the resurrection, we tell you the good news, right? In some of your translations, they'll say the gospel. We tell you the good news, what God promised our ancestors. By the way, this is also Paul speaking. This is his first recorded sermon. What God promised our ancestors, he has fulfilled for us, their children, by raising up Jesus, as it is written in the second Psalm, "You are my son. Today I have become your father." In what sense was the resurrection related to him being the son? Romans chapter 1, verses 4 and 5, it declared him the Son with power. I mean, what greater power is there, right? In chapter 4, verse 17, he's going to say, God who gives life and calls things that are not as though they were, right? And that's the power. The power, the resurrection shows his power, and it declares him to be the Son of God. And it is on that day that, by that declaration, you are my son. Today you have become my father. Very, very powerful stuff there. And since I'm on this page over in Acts, let's go ahead and hit this a little bit lower. This is what's highlighted on your screen there, is chapter 13 of Acts, verse 38. Therefore, my friends, I want you to know that through Jesus, the forgiveness of sins is proclaimed to you. Through him, everyone who believes is set free from sin, a justification you were not able to obtain under the law of Moses. Okay. Good place to act. This is not where I was going to do this in my notes, but it's as good a place as any to start it. What is the book of Romans really about? Underlined. The book of Romans is about God's plan for justification. What does Paul say about it in Acts chapter 13, verse 38. There are two things I can draw from that immediately that he's saying there. What is justification?
Like it never happened?
Atonement?
Okay. It It is being treated as if it never happened. It's an accounting term, right? It's wiping away, treating as justified, right? Here, what does he say is the equivalent of justification?
Forgiveness.
The forgiveness of sins. Isn't that what he's trying to talk about here when he's talking about justification? Forgiveness of sins. Now, does that come through the law of Moses? Was the law of Moses even capable of doing that? Well, were you capable of getting justification under the law of Moses?
Technically, yes, you could have if you were imperfect obedient to the law, but
under the law of Moses, perhaps the law was capable of it. You are not capable of it. According to the scripture, you were not able to obtain, right? And so the book of Romans is going to focus on this idea of justification. Remember, we started writing it up here a few weeks back, justification. And he's going to talk about, so he's going to talk about where justification comes in the first five chapters. And then we're going to start talking about where you live, chapter 6. And he's going to start talking about being sanctified in the Spirit. Okay? So let's start drilling into this concept. 1562? We're back on that page, 1562. Let's go down here, verse 18 of chapter 1. You guys know this, right? You know this. You've memorized this verse, probably. I am not ashamed of the gospel because it is the power of God that brings salvation to everyone who believes, first to the Jew, then to the Gentile. God is omnipotent, right? He has every form of power at his hands. What did he choose to use to bring salvation?
Written, spoken word.
There you go. I mean, the passage says the gospel, right? What does that mean? It means the news, the good news, the words. How did God, who has all of the power imaginable to raise men up, if he wanted to, could he reach in your heart and flip a switch and make you change? Absolutely he could. If he wanted to, could he say, I don't care what you've done, I'm just going to put you in heaven? Absolutely he could. Could he have done it any way he wanted to? Absolutely he could.
He could have also just given us the knowledge. We still got a choice, but he could have just automatically implanted the knowledge in our brains without being taught.
But he chose to do what? He chose to do it through the news, which is communication. You ought to be getting out of reading this year that our God, set apart from all other quote-unquote gods that man comes up with, one thing that absolutely sets him apart is that he is communicating, he is reasoning, in addition to the fact that he's real, right? I mean, but man doesn't even make up gods that are really communicating, right? Our God that we serve communicates. And that is how he chose to bring about salvation. To communicate it to us, Philip, in words. You're absolutely right. That's his power. He made us. I cannot get away without saying Genesis chapter 3, right? I mean, what was the state of man? And boy, I really want to talk about this in Romans 8. What was the state of man when he made man? Could man understand rules? Man could understand rules. How do we know that? God gave him. How many rules did God give him? He gave him one rule. Romans chapter 5, what did they do with that? They broke that one rule. What happened when they broke that one rule? Back up. Did God know they were going to break that rule? Yeah, God knew they were going to break that rule. So, what happened when they broke that rule? Okay, yes, they separate. They by their own action, caused separation from God. And what'd you say?
Or punishments.
Their punishment. What was their punishment?
Many things. First of all, just being kicked out of the garden.
Okay.
Had a lot of consequences.
They were put out of the garden. Why were they put out of the garden? There you go. Romans chapter 3, verse 21 and 22. It was so that they did not reach forth their hand and partake of the tree of life, which they hadn't been forbidden from, right? But if they partook of the tree of life at that point, what state would they be in? They would live forever in what condition, Gavin? In a broken relationship from God. Did he want that? He did not want that. So what did he do? He said, I'm punishing you by putting you out of the garden. That punishment was grace. Do you understand that? Because if they had reached out and grabbed that, they would live forever separated from God. What is that? That is 2 Thessalonians chapter 1, verses 7 through 9, eternal destruction from the face of the Lord. That's hell.
So physical death was grace.
Physical death was grace. Yes. All right. What else happened to them when they partook of the forbidden fruit? They had understanding that they could follow a single command, but they failed in it, right? God knew they were going to fail in it. We just established by our discussion, right? So in His grace, what was His one command? What was the... Just tell me the one command. You know this. You know the one command. What's the one command?
Don't
eat of the tree of what?
Knowledge of good and evil.
The tree of knowledge of good and evil. What happened? What happened when they ate of the tree of knowledge of good and evil?
They're naked and ashamed.
Their eyes were opened. Did they become... Satan said, oh, look at this fruit. It is beneficial to make you wise like God. You will know good and evil. Satan said that to them. Was Satan lying? He was lying when he said it was beneficial. Was he lying when he said, it will make you like God to know good and evil? How do I know he was not lying in that aspect of that statement? Because in Genesis chapter 3, sorry I'm banging, in Genesis chapter 3, God says, look, they are become like us to know good from evil. Boy, I'm going off on a tangent. My grandmother would be proud. Right? They knew, this is actually Romans. This is Romans chapter 5. What happened when they partook? They gained a state of ability to understand good and evil that they didn't have before. And I want you to understand, it was grace that God said, I'm going to give you one command, and that one command is going to be, you don't eat of that tree. Right? One... Why shouldn't they partake into that tree? Why was it bad for them to partake of that tree?
He said so.
Well, one, because he said so. All right? Did he say so because it was good or bad for them?
It's bad.
It was bad for them. Why was it bad for them?
Because then they would have the knowledge of good and evil. And?
Ignorance is bliss.
They would be responsible for their actions.
And the other part of that is, do we ever fully act in conformance with our knowledge of good and evil. Right? So did God know man? What God knew about man was man couldn't handle it. In a life of however many years, in of 969 years, or of 80 years. Right? Man couldn't handle it. So God said, don't partake of it. And when man partook of it and broke the rule, what happened to him? They gained the knowledge, right? It was bad for them, but it now sets up a situation when out of the garden, we are now dwelling in this land where Romans chapter 5, what has happened? We can now respond to the justification and the grace that is given to us, okay? There's majesty in the way he dealt with man in the very beginning. The thing that he prohibited when man broke the rule is the thing that allows us to respond. Right? And so he uses even Satan trying to mess up God's plan. He uses Satan to bring about his ultimate plan for justification. Now, continuing to talk about justification. back in the garden. Hey, I can link what we were just talking about to Romans chapter 1. The wrath of verse 18. The wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against all the godless and wickedness of people who suppress the truth by their wickedness. What do they do with the truth? They suppress it. Do they understand the truth? What I mean, what is the beginning of the book of Romans say? Let's back up and let's make sure that we understand what chapters 1 and 2... How can I back up any further than Genesis chapter 3? chapters 1 and 2 of Romans are telling you macro issue what? You can look here and you can look on your next page.
Man is in trouble.
There you go. Who? What man is in trouble?
All men.
All men. This is the message of chapters 1 and 2 of Romans. All men stand condemned. Right? And here at the beginning, we're talking about who? It's in your heading there. So, verse 18 heading. The Gentiles stand condemned. Why? Because they had the truth and they rejected it. Right? And... they are going to not have a love of the truth, and so they are going to deem it. I mean, we've got so many remarks that are made in here. Although they knew God, they neither glorified nor gave thanks to Him. The beginning of that last paragraph on that page. Then over on your next page, under the heading Sinfulness Replaced Purity, verse 28 of chapter 1. Furthermore, just as they did not think it worthwhile to retain the knowledge of God, what did they have? They had knowledge of God. What did they do? They chose to ignore it. True? Genesis chapter 3, knowledge of good and evil, right? They have capacity. And in fact, he's going to say down here at the bottom of this page in verses 12 through 16 in the parenthetical there at the very bottom of the page, indeed, when the Gentiles who do not have the law, now that is the Mosaic law, right? Who do not have the law, do by nature things required by the law. They are a law for themselves, even though they do not have the law. They show that the requirements of the law are written on their hearts, their consciences also bearing witness, and their thoughts sometimes accusing them, and at other times even defending them. What is he saying? He's saying that the Gentiles, even though they don't have the law, do what?
Know the law.
They know it. They understand. Why do they understand? Genesis chapter 3. Right? I mean, that's what's going on here. And so he's talking in chapters 1 and 2. He starts talking about the Gentiles and he's saying, those Gentiles, they stand to be condemned. And at about this point... you can hear the Jews are over there doing what? I mean, can't you just sort of hear the Jews cheering that on? Yeah, because look at what he's going to say next. I mean, you kind of get the sense that he knows that the Jews are going to be reading this saying, yeah, those filthy Gentiles. I mean, we are right to look at them and say they're condemned. They didn't have the law, but they got no excuse anyway. And now he's going to turn on the Jews and he's going to say... where am I? I've gone too far. He's going to say, chapter 2, verse 1. You therefore have no excuse, you who pass judgment on someone else, right? And he's going to say, over back on page 1564, chapter 2, verse 17. Now, if you call yourself a Jew, if you rely on the law and boast in God, if you know His will and approve of what is superior because you're instructed by the law, if you're convinced that you're a guide to the blind, a light to those who are in dark, an instructor to the foolish, a teacher of little children, etc., etc., what?
You not teach yourself.
You're not teaching yourself. What are you doing? You're breaking that law, right? And so his message is, I know I'm flipping through the pages here. His message of these first two chapters is Romans chapter 2, verse 12. All who sin apart from the law will also perish apart from the law. All who sin under the law will be judged by the law. Go over to your next page. It's on your, it's page 1564. And he's going to make the point plain. Romans chapter 3, verse 9. What shall we conclude then? Do we have any advantage? Not at all, for we have already made the charge that Jews and Gentiles alike are all under the power of sin. That's what he's been building up to in chapters 1 and 2, right? And then so chapter 3 here, your arranger has given you the heading, God's judgment is just, the result of the fact that all men stand under condemnation, because even without the law, you understand enough to be condemned by your actions in face of what you know. And with the law, you don't follow the law, so you stand condemned by the law. And so the upshot of that is God is just in his condemnation, right? God is just in his condemnation of both the Jew and the Greek. And then that's where we get over to chapter 3, big time. Verse 19. Verse 19. Now we know that whatever the law says, it says to those who are under the law, so that every mouth may be silenced and the whole world held accountable to God. Therefore, no one will be declared righteous in God's sight by works of the law. Rather, through the law, we become conscious of our sin. All right, nobody is going to be declared righteous by works of the law. You've got friends in the religious world who want to point that out. That's what Paul is talking about in the book of Romans, right? You're not righteous by works. What are you righteous by? You're declared righteous by faith. Absolutely. Does he say that? Yes, he does. Right? What was the purpose of the law? Let's start there.
To bring us to Christ, to teach us.
Okay, you're going Galatians on me. It's a good place to go. It was to bring us to Christ. It was to be a schoolmaster. As he's speaking of it here in Romans chapter 3, specifically, what's it doing to bring us to Christ?
Convict us.
Through the law, we become conscious of our sin. I like the way you said it, Roger. It convicts us. So, wait a minute. We just had this lengthy diatribe about Galatians chapter 3, and we've just heard Paul talk about the Gentiles having a law unto themselves, even when they don't have the law. How in the world does this law make us conscious of our sin? Does this statement here stand for the proposition that in the absence of the Mosaic law, people would be free from guilt of sin?
No.
No. What does it mean?
Well, this means if you're part of the law, you have more of a responsibility, or you're...
That's a very good point. You have more responsibility. Why?
Because you know black and white what God expects.
It's a gray area.
Because the law is teaching us. So we have an understanding of the knowledge of good and evil, but it's imperfect. Right? And what is the law doing? The law is giving you the epi-knowledge. And I'm using that term, that coined term, intentionally. What's the epicenter of something? When you have an earthquake, what's the epicenter?
It's
the core of it. It's right where it is. It's really where it happened. And we feel the earthquake everywhere else. But it's really where it happened. This word conscious right here is epinosis. G-N-O-S-I-S. Epi-knowledge. Right? And so what this... And the King James Version is going to render that acknowledgement. Right? And so the sense here is the law takes your untrained knowledge of good and evil and says, let me tell you more about it. And now you've got the law and you are saying the law is true, the law is just, the law is good, it comes from God. Paul is going to say elsewhere in here, you have no excuse, O man. That's what the law did. It robs man of the ability to say, oh, if you had just told me. Well, I did. That's God's answer. Right? It's in a way, it's like Hebrews chapter 4, when the writer of Hebrews says, we have no excuse because we have that high priest. right? Who has been tempted in every respect as we. We don't have the ability to say, oh, if you just went through what I went through. Well, he did. Oh, if you had just told me. He did. Right? And Romans chapter 5. Romans chapter 5. Let's go there. What page is that? Somebody give me Romans chapter 5. And we'll come back to Romans chapter 3 because we have to. 1567. Yeah. Chapter 5, verse... that's not where I'm going to go, to 12. I do want to go... boy, I want to go verse 1. But therefore, verse 12. Therefore, just as sin entered the world through one man and death through sin, and this way death came to all people because all sinned. To be sure, sin was in the world before the law was given, but sin is not charged against anyone's account where there is no law. You see how these... there's similar language here, right? We became conscious of sin through the law. Now we're in Romans chapter 5, and he says, sin is not charged against anyone's account where there is no law. Nevertheless, death reigned from the time of Adam to the time of Moses, even over those who did not sin by breaking a command, as did Adam, who is a pattern of the one to come. Even in the absence of the Mosaic law, death reigned. Right? It says that. Sin is not charged where there's no law. But if death reigned even before the law of Moses, what is the natural, necessary conclusion of what he's saying there? He doesn't actually state this.
There's always been law.
There's always been law. Right? Don't miss the fact that he's saying that in Romans chapter 5. In Romans chapter 5, he is saying, Adam sinned. Right? Did he have a law? Yes, he did. What was the law? One command. Right? And so he's going to say, death reigns from the time of Adam to the time of Moses, even those who did not sin by breaking a command, as did Adam. What was it in the time of Adam? It was a law of one command. And he broke the one express command. What was it in the time of Moses? Huh? It's a law, it's a system of laws, a very detailed explanation of what's good and what's bad, a whole system to follow, right? What's in between the two? Anarchy?
In between
knowledge of good and evil.
It's the days of the patriarchs when God is dealing individually with the heads of families and they are charged with following Him in the presence of their knowledge of good and evil and responding to Him. All right, so in the nature of man has no excuse, what kinds of systems of law could God give? He could give you a simple, easy one to follow. Does man do well with that? Oh, if you had just made it easy and given me one, oh God, I did that. Right? Oh, if you had just made it easy and given us knowledge of good and evil, and then you talk to us directly to our heads of household, and it's sort of ad hoc, and we deal with each individual as each individual needs to be dealt with. If you had just done that, well, he did that. Oh, if you had given me a real clear system of laws and priests to teach it to me, and prophets to keep me on track. He did that. Can man keep law? Is it because God didn't do the law right? What's it because of? It's because all sin, right? That's exactly what all of that is talking about. All right, so that's the state that man finds himself in. Let's go back to chapter 3. Chapter 3. But now, apart from the law, the righteous... I'm in verse 21, chapter 3, verse 21. But now, apart from the law, the righteousness of God has been made, to which the law and the prophets testify. This righteousness is given through faith in Christ, in Jesus Christ, to all who believe. First of all, to whom is the righteousness given?
All who believe.
All who believe. Did we already see that? I mean, that was in his salutation at the beginning of the book, right? It was to those who believe. There is no difference between Jew and Gentile. Remember, chapters 1 and 2, both of them are under condemnation. There is no difference between Jew and Gentile, for all have sinned and fallen short and fall short of the glory of God. Then what?
All can be justified.
All are justified freely by His grace through the redemption that came by Christ Jesus. God presented Christ as a sacrifice of atonement through the shedding of His blood to be received by faith. He did this to demonstrate His righteousness because in His forbearance He had left the sins committed beforehand unpunished. He did it to demonstrate His righteousness at the present time so as to be just and the one who justifies those who have faith in Jesus. We could camp here for all of the time we have left in this entire year and not exhaust everything that's in this paragraph. This is extraordinary, right? So, the proposition is we're all the same. Jews and Gentiles, we've all had law, we've all broken it. Neither has any benefit over the other, and that God is going to deal with us all just the same. And how does He want to deal with us? He wants to justify freely, right? He wants to treat you as justified, which is Acts chapter 13, 38, not a possible for you under the law of Moses. So something else has to be done. God is just. We just established that's part of what chapter 3 is about. A just God has to do what? It is impossible for God to... It is impossible for God to lie. If God said, you must, and if you don't, you will be punished. What does God have to do to be true to His own character? He must punish, right? Does God want to punish you? God does not want to punish you. He has shown His forbearance in leaving the sins committed beforehand unpunished. Can He keep doing that? He has to punish sin because He said He would, right? Sin must be met with punishment. This paragraph tells you, and that's a quandary, right? God wants to treat you as justified, but God must be just. And just requires exacting the punishment that He said there would be. And what is that punishment? Genesis chapter 3. Death. Actually, that's chapter 2. But still. Right? But He doesn't want us to die. So what does He do? Alright, He gives you a substitute and that's in here. Right? See what's going on here. What did He do? He presented Christ as a sacrifice of atonement. What's atonement mean? I don't know if he gets this right in the footnote.
To cover up.
Yeah, it's a covering, right? It's a covering. It covers over those sins through the shedding of His blood, through death, right? I'm not skipping over stuff to skip the concept. We'll come back to it. So he gives... He wants to justify you. He therefore gives Christ as a sacrifice of atonement, and that allows Him to do what? End of this paragraph. Because He has substituted somebody in to take the punishment for you, someone who is willing to do it, He is therefore able to be just. How can He be just? Because He said you're going to have to pay the price. Has the price been paid? The price was paid. Who paid the price? Jesus did. God put that price in our hands for us. He said, I have to demand that you pay the price. Here's your payment. Give it back to me. Right? And that allows Him to at the same time be just and the justifier. If you don't get anything else in Scripture, get that. Right? The sin is a quandary for God, or it would be if he weren't as almighty and all-powerful and brilliant as he is. He solves the quandary by suffering himself, by paying the price for us. Thus, the price is paid, and he can still look upon us and treat us as justified. That's the majesty of the cross, right? It allows God to be true to himself and still love us and give us justification. Now, how do you get that justification? It's freely given, right? So it's a gift. What do you have to do when somebody gives you a gift? What's that?
Accept it.
You have to accept it. You got to say thank you. You've got to receive it. How do you receive the gift freely given? According to that passage. How do you receive it? I'm not making stuff up. Right? God presented Christ as a sacrifice. What's the gift? Christ as a sacrifice. Did you merit Christ as a sacrifice? Right? And so, what? Through the shedding of blood, to be received by faith. How do you receive the free gift? How do you accept it? I mean, look, if I give my child a gift, my child can refuse to take the gift. Sometimes my gift is punishment even. And sometimes they refuse to receive that. And they don't get the benefits of my punishment. They just get more punishment. You can refuse to accept. How do you refuse to accept? You refuse to have faith. Right? Okay. Now, how is, through what is justification? This paragraph.
Faith.
Okay. I can accept either answer. There are two answers to it, right? At its core, justification is by what? Freely, justified freely by what?
Grace.
By grace. How do you step into the grace?
Through faith.
Through faith, by faith, right? All right, that is actually very important for some doctrinal error that is out there, right? There's some doctrine out there that says you have inherited sin, you are unable, you are totally depraved, and therefore faith is not something you can just have, right? That wasn't the second bell. Was that the second bell?
Yeah.
We're going to ignore that for a moment. All right. There is a doctrine that says you are unable to respond. You can't have faith. God has to do something to give you that faith. Right? Go study these verses and see if that stands up. And we'll talk more about this on what is that next day? Wednesday. We'll study this more on Wednesday. God gives the justification by grace. It really, its foundation is grace. How do you get to it? You get to it by having faith. Does he by grace give you faith? Go read for Wednesday. Go read chapter 4, verse 16. It is by faith. It's on the facing page here. It is by faith so that it may be of grace. Go read chapter 5, verse 1. We have access into this grace by faith. If God comes in and flips a switch in your heart and makes you have faith, which came first, grace or faith?
Grace.
All right? So the goal here is for it to be of grace. How has God told you you get into, chapter 5, verse 1, you get into that state of grace? You have faith in order to access the grace. You have to respond. You have to respond. Can you? Well, Genesis chapter 3, you've been made to be like unto God in understanding good from evil. What is his power unto salvation? He communicated it to you. You can understand it because of what he orchestrated in the garden to use man's own rejection as the way to lay the foundation for man to return. And that is, you have to have faith to accept the grace. And that is what he is talking about in chapters 4 and 5, straight throughout. All right? I ran past the bell. I apologize. I'm still hyped up.